Welcome to Indie Film Weekly, a No Film School podcast. I'm Liz Nord, editor-in-chief of No Film School.
And I'm Ryan Koo, founder of No Film School. It is April 5th, 2016.
On this week's show, you'll hear about more film studios trying to affect southern state laws, why it's been a great week for indie films theatrically, some international YouTube news, and as always, new gear, indie releases, and upcoming filmmaker opportunities.
As always, this is Indie Film Weekly, where we try to catch you up on the things you might have missed while you were busy working on film projects. We are recording this from downtown Brooklyn, New York. That is the same as normal, but what is new for us is we are now listed in iTunes' New and Noteworthy podcast section, which I just saw, which is great. So thank you if you have rated us in iTunes. If you haven't, now would be a great time to go do that. And please subscribe.
Woo! In some other exciting news right here on the home front, we are hiring at No Film School. We're looking for a technology editor and video director. That's one job. We're looking for somebody who can shoot, edit, and write about those things. That's most important. We want to bring you on board if you are really excited about all the latest gear and want to be the first one to tell everybody about it. We've put the announcement out last week. We've gotten tons of applications already, not going to lie, but we're still looking for the perfect person, so check it out on nofilmschool.com.
To apply, you can email jobs@nofilmschool.com, and please be sure to use the word video in your subject line. On to the news. So following up on our news last week about the Georgia governor vetoing a new anti-LGBT law after major movie studios threatened to pull productions from the state, now we have news that Lionsgate and the A&E Network say they won't film TV shows and movies in North Carolina if the state, my home state, doesn't repeal its new LGBT law. Liz, what exactly is this new law?
So the law is similar to the one that we talked about last week in Georgia. It basically replaces local ordinances with a statewide non-discrimination law. So you'd think, oh, that's nice. They're going to have a statewide non-discrimination law that protects a lot of people. But it's sort of insidious language because actually the non-discrimination law doesn't include sexual orientation and gender identity as protected categories. So this non-discrimination law overrides any existing non-discrimination laws about all around the state, but it doesn't protect gender identity and sexual orientation.
The thing that we've never seen before is film companies having this much of an impact on states because the film companies bring their business there to film on location and to qualify for the state's tax credits.
So the anti-LGBT legislation in Georgia and North Carolina were very similar. The difference is that the Georgia governor vetoed the law. It never passed once the film companies threatened to pull out. But in North Carolina, the governor, Pat McCrory, has not only signed the bill into law, but has actively defended it. So what film companies like Lionsgate and A&E are trying to do now is to say, we're going to pull our productions from the state unless you repeal the already passed law. And both of those companies already have film productions going on in the state, so it actually would make a real impact.
Here on Indie Film Weekly, we always want to talk about what actionable item a filmmaker can take. In this case, the obvious one would be to not film in North Carolina. But when they raised the budget floor of what you needed to spend in state to qualify for the tax credit from $250,000 to $5 million, a lot of us indies already were not filming in North Carolina.
So a big fat no thanks to North Carolina. Love, No Film School. So there's also been an update on some of the other news we reported on last week. We talked about how the film Vaxxed, the documentary, was pulled from the Tribeca lineup because of its controversial anti-vaccination stance. New York's venerable Angelica Theater, which is one of our, you know, stalwart indie theaters, smartly jumped on the film as soon as Tribeca pulled it, and they programmed it in their lineup. It opened this past weekend, and it brought in $22,000 in one weekend.
Any publicity is good publicity. Speaking of publicity, we actually talked to the filmmaker who wrote Tribeca an open letter, Penny Lane, after last week's episode of Indie Film Weekly, and got her take on what it's like to essentially write a festival a open letter saying that they should remove a film from their lineup when you yourself are a filmmaker and it could potentially hurt your own career in a way.
As we mentioned in last week's show, we applaud Penny for taking such a public stance on the issue, and ultimately the film did get pulled. And I definitely encourage you to check out our exclusive interview with her on No Film School, because she really goes into sort of why she took a stance which in itself was controversial as a filmmaker. And Vaxxed was not the only indie theatrical release this past weekend that was getting lots of buzz and attention. It was actually a great weekend overall for indie films. A couple of films from this year's South by Southwest Festival, where we just did a bunch of reporting, got released this past weekend. Richard Linklater's Everybody Wants Some and Miles Ahead, the Miles Davis biopic with Don Cheadle, were both released in limited capacity, and they are performing really well. It looks like there's a high likelihood of expanded releases for both of them.
Yeah, typically February and March are sort of the post-awards season dumping ground for movies that were maybe originally slated to come out during awards season, and then it got really, really crowded, so the films came out in the months of February and March, but now we're getting back into sort of high season. Miles Ahead stars Don Cheadle, who also directed and co-wrote, and he has a really interesting take on the biopic. Obviously, biopics are well-trod territory, especially when it comes to musicians, where you have an almost inevitable descent into substance abuse, potentially spousal abuse. It's just things that we've seen before. And so Don's solution to that was just to make shit up. And a lot of it, including the journalist, the Rolling Stone journalist played by Ewan McGregor, the car chase, the guns. Apparently these things did not happen, but it was Don's attempt to capture the spirit of Miles Davis.
Is that even like okay?
Well, I wasn't there, so I can't say for sure what was true or not, but it's a great performance by Don in the film, and we have a podcast interview with the DP, Roberto Schaefer, from Sundance, where the film also played, and he shot on a variety of formats for the different time periods presented in the film, including on Super 16, Alexa, and the Canon C500. He even, in the podcast, mentions the mobile apps that he used on his phone during location scouts. So definitely check that out. He is a very well-known DP, including of small franchise films like James Bond, Quantum of Solace.
Wow, but he's done a bunch of indie stuff too, right?
Right, yeah. Monsters Ball, Best in Show. Anyway, enough self-promo. Check out the podcast.
So there are other indie films that have just been, you know, continuing to do well theatrically in their first couple of weeks post-award season, as Ryan said. So Eye in the Sky is still doing really well. Midnight Special seems to be all over the place. I'm seeing celebrities tweet about it. I saw ads on TV. In its third week, it went from 5 to 58 theaters. Really big deal for indies.
Well, Midnight Special, not actually an indie. It's from an indie director, Jeff Nichols, who you may know from Shotgun Stories, Take Shelter, and most recently Mud. Each one of those films was increasingly larger in size. Each one of those films was, as far as I know, seen by an increasing number of people. But Jeff wanted to make something that jumped a level in terms of the potential audience size. And Midnight Special is sort of his take on a Spielbergian sci-fi. He took it straight to Warner Brothers, so it's actually technically a studio film, had $23 million budget. So in going from 5 to 58 theaters, I would only imagine it's going to go to hundreds, if not thousands of theaters, in order for Warner Brothers to succeed with that.
So I haven't actually seen it, but I've heard other people make that Spielberg comparison. What do you think? I mean, is it like because there's a certain kind of sweetness to it, like in Spielberg's films, or it has a similar like visual vibe? What do you think that comparison comes from?
I would say both. I mean, it's a sci-fi with a kid. Jeff is a father, and he's certainly exploring personal themes there. It's got some E.T.-like special effects elements to it. But actually, ultimately, there's the ending of the film is, I loved it, but it's also kind of confounding. And I'm interested to see how the larger country as a whole receives it and whether it expands to the level that Warner Brothers wants it to. Along with Michael Shannon and Kirsten Dunst, the film stars Joel Edgerton from Warrior and Black Mass. He's also a writer and director, most recently directing the feature film The Gift. And I saw him on a panel at South by Southwest where I thought he had a telling quote about filmmaking in general. Edgerton said of filmmaking today, "The equipment is cheaper, better, faster. There's no excuse for not making stuff. You're not a doctor unless you work with patients. You're not a filmmaker unless you make films. Why sit around and say, I'd like to do something? You've just got to do it. You might fail at first. Your failures are what are going to allow you to move on to success. I wrote a screenplay and that was terrible and it will never see the light of day because it had no spine. So I started reading screenplay books In the days prior to YouTube, reading books and talking to people was our university, which obviously is a no film school philosophy as well.
I actually love that about our site and our community. I've only been here now like 6 weeks, I guess. And I feel like every interview I've conducted, everyone I've read, everyone I've heard about and listened to the podcast, all the filmmakers are always saying, like, just do it, just do it. I know that's a Nike thing, but I think it's special. You know, filmmaking is sort of a kind of a universally collaborative in a way. Like, we're all rooting for each other. Everybody's just saying, you got to just get out there and do it, and you can. And I think it's unique in this industry.
Well, the industry is certainly not one that's fast moving when you're trying to make things involving other entities. And as somebody who's working on my first feature for quite some time now, it's always good advice to say, hey, I remember when I was just making stuff. And in some ways, you always wish you still were, even when you're working on these larger scale projects that wouldn't be possible in that configuration.
So yeah, so back to theatrical releases and how well indies are doing. It's not just in the States. Actually, it's kind of exciting. I read that the New Zealand indie Hunt for the Wilder People, which debuted at Sundance this year, actually broke box office records in New Zealand. It beat the second weekend of Batman versus Superman, which I don't know if that's like such a great accomplishment. But the real accomplishment is that Hunt for the Wilder People made this past Saturday the highest grossing day for a New Zealand-made film ever. And the film was picked up shortly after Sundance by Orchard in the U.S., and so it should be coming out theatrically here this summer. It definitely sounds worth looking out for. China is basically pretending that Hong Kong's Best Film Award winner does not exist. Basically, Hong Kong has big film awards. They're like the Oscars of Hong Kong. And the winner for best film this year was actually a micro-budget feature, so a pretty indie film called 10 Years. It made $6 million Hong Kong dollars in its opening weekend, and then it took away this top prize for best picture, except that when the awards show was broadcast in China, they just muted the best picture award, and then none of the Chinese newspaper reports included that category. They included like best actor, best actress, and they just chopped off best film because apparently that film has some anti-communist critique in it. And it's particularly interesting in light of some articles we've posted recently about the challenges of indie filmmaking in China and the changing Chinese box office. It's going to be a really interesting region to watch for so many reasons. But I think in terms of indie cinema, this particular story shows that there's some cracks breaking through and that indie and small budget filmmakers are actually making real impact. And we'll see if that ends up reaching mainland China.
Well, as a North Carolinian with Chinese heritage, not a banner week for my background here on this podcast.
Oh, but you know, I don't know what to say, Ryan. You're representing for the best. I mean, you're making change from the inside, something. I don't
there
know.
There we go.
And on to more things currently unavailable in China. The YouTube analytics site VidStax just released an interesting number. There are now 2,000 YouTube channels with at least 1 million subscribers. And maybe this doesn't strike you as surprising at first because there's just so many darn people viewing YouTube. But I think what's interesting about it is how rapidly that number has grown. So in 2010, when YouTube was 5 years old, there were only 5 channels with at least 1 million subscribers. And now it's only 6 years later. And as I mentioned, there are 2,000. And apparently, according to TubeFilter, 850 of those are new channels that have joined the ranks of 1 million subscribers in the past year. And there's some debate about this in kind of the YouTube community because some of those 1 million-plus subscriber channels are like big corporate entities like Vivo and Stephen Colbert, whatever, celebrities. But there's also tons of indie people on that 1 million-plus subscriber kind of train who are just makers, you know, independent makers doing stuff completely DIY, even more DIY than, you know, what we might consider sort of filmmaking, like in the bedroom cam. And I don't mean the dirty kind. And this has other implications for indie filmmakers because careers are being launched off of YouTube. We actually put up an interview this week on No Film School with Daniel Park, who is a director who has a really funny web series called K-Town Cowboys, and he turned that into a feature which debuted at South by Southwest last year and now was released this past week on iTunes.
YouTube's a really interesting place because the speculation has always been that as larger brands got involved, the indies were going to be pushed out. But of course, it's a bit different where, as an indie filmmaker, you still have access to the upload button. You're still able to make work and just distribute it. But the question is, in terms of what advertisers desire, whether an online distribution channel like YouTube is going to go the way of theaters, where it becomes a lot of really big multiplexes that most people are watching, and then much smaller entities.
I mean, a lot of filmmakers have their reservations about YouTube in terms of, like, if I consider myself an artist, is this a platform for me? But I think it's just sort of a platform and a tool like anything else. Your work should speak for itself. And if you have the opportunity, I mean, my view is if you have the opportunity to reach tens of thousands or, you know, in this case, millions of people, why not try to take advantage of that?
And with YouTube Red out, they're becoming much more of like a Netflix or a Hulu, where it's a paid subscription for $10 a month. And it's not reliant on ad revenue anymore, but it's actually a rev share. I just don't think, based on how YouTube launched and what people have grown to expect from the channel, that the paywall is ever going to work there. I don't know. How do you feel about that, Liz?
It's hard to imagine people paying for YouTube content, but, you know, remains to be seen. And right now, as a filmmaker, I would look at YouTube as a place to launch my work, potentially to reach out to audiences, to build social media, to build social capital, to potentially get that kind of subscriber base where you could end up making money. But I, at this point, I don't look at it as like a place I'm going to go to try to make a living. I will give them credit from sort of the indie filmmaker perspective that they really do, you know, once you start to get viewers sort of on your own and build up an audience, YouTube does a ton to support people at no charge. You know, they invite filmmakers into their studios, which are really high-end production studios, where essentially anybody can kind of mess around and learn sort of bigger, better filmmaking tools than you might have at home. And they offer their YouTube playbooks for free, where they give lots of tips on just lighting and making stuff. So I think it's still really fertile ground. I wouldn't turn my nose up at it.
Moving on to technology-related news, it's kind of the calm before the storm. We didn't have a lot of stories this past week because the huge film video trade show in Las Vegas, NAB, is coming up in a couple of weeks, April 16th through the 21st. So a lot of manufacturers are holding back their latest camera news, their post-production tools news. That's going to be coming to you soon. But we did have a few stories in the last week to pay attention to. The world of action cams is pretty crowded with GoPro, Sony, Contour, but there's a new camera called the Revel Arc. The difference between the Revel and the others is stabilization. When you're on your snowboard, when you're wakeboarding, bungee jumping, whatever it is that extreme people are doing, obviously not exactly the most stable platform for filming. So Revel is calling their camera the first stabilized 4K smart action camera. So not only are they offering more resolution, but it has sensors that measure rotation, speed, cardinal direction, and elevation, and it keeps it steady throughout using a motorized gimbal. So this is a tiny little camera aimed at action uses, but as someone making a sports film, I've also been paying attention to these devices. We're trying to get into tighter spaces and be more agile than a traditional film would be. And so something like a 4K gimbal stabilized camera actually perks my ears up for narrative use. I couldn't find out whether it has a raw codec or whether it's, you know, super compressed video, more like a consumer level thing. But when you have movies like Tangerine being shot on an iPhone, I would not ignore these things. The Revel Arc is currently on Indiegogo for $400, and it will be shipping in December, which hopefully means I won't be able to use it on my film anyway, because I will have shot by then.
And also, I would say that, you know, you wouldn't want to plan your shoot around this, because we've definitely seen Indiegogo or Kickstarter releases in the past that are quite delayed. Still, it looks like a pretty cool toy to keep your eye on.
In the post-production world, Blackmagic has released their Fusion 8 node-based compositing software for the first time on the Mac. Fusion 8 has been used on over 1,000 major Hollywood films, including Thor and The Hunger Games, but it's never been available on a Macintosh, and they've actually made Fusion 8 available for free, and that is available to download now. If you want to upgrade to the studio version, it's $1,000, but costs you nothing to check it out. one of the areas that innovation is actually happening rapidly in right now is lighting. They're getting smaller, they're getting more flexible, they're drawing less power. And on No Film School, we have a review from our own Micah Van Hove of the Roscoe LightPad Vector. Now, the original light pads are what we have at No Film School. They are basically like a thick piece of cloth, and they have LEDs all over them. So it's almost like throwing a manila folder in your backpack or something. It's crazy that you can bring a high-powered light into a situation where if you don't have a light stand and you're just putting it on a desk or you're wrapping it around something, the fact that it's dimmable and the color temperature is variable makes it just a really flexible tool. It might not be as high quality as a traditional tungsten-based light, but just the ability to bring it places is what has attracted us to it. The Vector is more of a traditional light. It's not flexible, it's not cloth-based, but it's a little bit more powerful. And you should check out Micah's review for more. Lighting is changing in really interesting ways these days, especially in the arena of really small, agile productions.
Okay, we've got some great grant and opportunity deadlines for y'all this week. The IFP Project Forum is coming up. That's a big one. It's part of the Independent Film Week in New York, which is the only international co-production market for film in the whole U.S. And the Project Forum gives an opportunity for you doc and narrative people in all sorts of stages of production to basically submit your film. And if you get selected, which you have a pretty good chance of, there's about 150 films selected every year. If you get selected, you have the opportunity to meet with and pitch directly to all sorts of influential people, from financiers to programmers to people that can really move your film forward.
I love IFP. My own film, Amateur, went through a couple of different IFP programs, and I've had other projects in IFP programs. What happens every year is when you see films that were a success on the festival level, on the awards level, a lot of those films in their very early days were selected for these programs. And that's where filmmakers get a chance to meet producers. They get a chance to identify financing sources. Grant-making organizations are paying attention to the movies that are being selected for IFP. It's really just a great opportunity, and I encourage people to apply.
The narrative applications are open now, and the documentary applications open this week on April 8th. The week-long event actually takes place in New York. This year it's moving to Brooklyn for the first time, but moving all the way across the globe, we have an opportunity in Africa. If you're a filmmaker working in Africa, the Art Moves Africa grant offers you travel money to travel within the continent in order to establish partnerships, to participate in festivals, to share your work and collaborate with other African artists. So the process there is that a selection committee reviews and selects the applicants once every 4 months, and the next deadline is April 24th.
HBO has their HBO Access Directing Fellowship. It's for emerging diverse voices who would like to make a short film with HBO. Filmmakers who are selected will participate in a one-week session of mentorship and education in July, and they'll receive a production budget and a crew to shoot a short pilot in the late summer that will potentially air on HBO. This is a quick deadline here. It opens April 6th and closes April 9th. So
get on top of it this week. That's a great opportunity because of the name HBO provides. But there's a great opportunity for big, big dollars if you're an Australian-based filmmaker. Screen Australia is the sort of national Australian film board, and it's a government film agency. They give up to $2 million for films of any budget size. So you could be a micro-budget, you could be a doc, you could be, you know, a large format program. They just have to be feature-length projects and intended for theatrical release. The website says that the program aims to assist in the creation of a diverse range of successful Australian films that resonate with their audiences. So entertaining, enlightening, reflect an Australian sense of identity. It's a huge pot of money. So if you're in Australia, please, for all of us, apply by April 15th. If you've got a short, low-budget independent or a documentary film, you may want to consider applying for the Roy W. Dean Grant. They support film and video projects that are unique and benefit society, so it's a pretty wide range. The grants primarily provide gear, but it's a good set of gear. It's about $30,000 worth of, not gear, but goods and services donated by various companies in the film and video industry. And I've actually been a finalist for this grant. What's cool about it is that the person who runs the grants, Carol Dean, she's the daughter of Roy W. Dean, who was a film stock provider. She professionally gives workshops on funding films. And so if you are a finalist, even if you don't win the grant and win the support, she will give you a free phone consultation. So when I was a finalist with my film Battle for Jerusalem, she and I spoke on the phone for a good while, and she was really, really helpful. So that's a pretty rare opportunity. Most grants don't even let you find out anything about why you were or weren't selected. So I encourage you all to apply. Deadline's April 30th.
If you are wrapping up a cut of your film and wondering where to take it, there are some upcoming film festival deadlines to be aware of. The Breckenridge Film Festival, which, if you know where Breckenridge, is that Colorado? I don't even know where it is. It's in a place where they have snow and mountains. So if you like skiing, or if your movie's about skiing, check out the Breckenridge Film Festival deadline is April 8th, and they offer lodging to attending filmmakers. So if you like skiing while your movie's playing at a festival and your housing is paid for, check that out.
Big plus. For short filmmakers, opportunities are more limited, but the San Jose International Shorts Festival programs over 150 of them each year, and Movie Maker Magazine has called it one of its top 50 film festivals worth the entry fee. It's in San Jose, California, and the deadline for submission is April 8th.
Movie Maker Magazine does these lists of coolest film festivals in the world. It's always nice to have a filter for how many film festivals are out there. One of the coolest film festivals in the world is the Portland Film Festival. The late deadline is April 8th.
Another film festival in a very cool city is the Chicago International Film Festival. That festival's been going on for 52 years. It's one of the main cultural importers of world cinema to the Midwest. It's gotten things in common with other international film festivals like the San Francisco International Film Festival in that it has a bunch of screenings, panels, other kinds of events and parties. It tries to bring filmmakers to the festival. It has lots of films. It's very global. So if you're into, if you want your film sort of in the mix with an international group of films, I encourage you to apply by their early bird deadline of April 8th.
If you have a LGBT-oriented film, the Real Affirmation Festival in Washington, D.C. has a deadline of April 11th. It takes place in October and has a number of community partnerships, including a grant program to support LGBT filmmakers. Now, in the world of festivals, but slightly different, is the Slamdance Screenplay Competition. This takes place during the week of Sundance, but it's actually a competition for screenplays, including short screenplays, feature, and horror categories. The top three scripts will win awards, and Slamdance presents the grand prize for best screenplay, who receives $5,000 in cash. The deadline for the Slamdance Screenplay Competition is April 11th. That's the early bird deadline, though, so you still got time if you're shaping that draft.
So we've gotten feedback from some of you guys that, it's great to hear about these grants and other opportunities, but then how do you apply? And it would be a little silly for us to try to speak out all of the URLs for all of the applications for some of these, which are quite long, but we always compile everything into a post that accompanies this podcast on nofilmschool.com. So if you go to nofilmschool.com/podcast or /podcasts, you will see the most recent Indie Film Weekly episode post, and within that post, you can get links to all of these opportunities. There's a bunch of good movies opening up or becoming available on demand this week.
Havana Motor Club is a documentary that we featured on No Film School. It is a documentary about drag racing in Cuba. Now, as you know, Cuba does not have the most recent technology or automobiles, so the drag racers are using older American muscle cars, and they are characters. Director Bent Jorgen Perlmutt did a post for us on New Film School entitled 10 Things I Learned About Making a Film in Cuba. So you can watch the resulting film on demand this weekend.
If you're an Amazon Prime Instant member, you can check out David O. Russell's latest movie, Joy, on April 8th with everybody's favorite, Jennifer Lawrence. And on April 9th on Amazon Prime Instant, Maggie's being released. This was a Tribeca indie standout from last year. It's weird for me to say indie film and Arnold Schwarzenegger in the same sentence, but apparently Arnold Schwarzenegger stars in this indie film as a man who has to care for his...
yes, that's right. His daughter is a zombie, correct. So whether or not that's an indie, the other question is whether David O. Russell movies are indies at this point. He's been eligible at the Spirit Awards via some budget exceptions, but a Jennifer Lawrence, Robert De Niro starring vehicle Joy, maybe not so indie.
It's like in the spirit of indies.
It is in the spirit of indies. It is about a woman who invented the Wonder Mop. So that does sound like an indie log line. We'll give him that.
DIY. The mop. Also on April 8th on Netflix, the straight-to-Netflix horror release Hush is coming out. It's from the director of those Ouija and Oculus movies. I guess, like, it's also considered indie because it's just like a genre horror, low budget.
Yeah, I mean, horror movies, the one area where making low budget movies can actually turn financial profit.
And we'll see if the theatrical releases this weekend do as well as the ones we talked about at the top of the show. One I'm really eager slash a little bit nervous to see is Hardcore Henry. We had an article up about it earlier this month. It's the first action movie done completely POV from a GoPro. So that means that the lead actor was wearing a GoPro the entire time. And so when you are watching the movie, it's as though you are the main character. And I have to say, I got a little queasy from the trailer alone, feeling like I was getting my face stomped in. Not sure it's a feeling I really want to have, but I sort of can't resist, just like I think a lot of people won't be able to resist just the sheer, gimmick of it all.
Well, it looks pretty gonzo in terms of what's depicted from that point of view. As we were talking about earlier, new ways to tell stories using smaller cameras, that's Exhibit A. On the topic of other things we've already mentioned, Everybody Wants Some was in limited release. It is expanding this weekend, so check to see if Richard Linklater's spiritual sequel to Dazed and Confused is in your town. Also coming out in theaters is Louder Than Bombs, which is the story of a widower played by Gabriel Byrne dealing with the death of his wife, who was a famed war photographer.
Coinciding with the release, we've got an interview with the director Joachim Trier coming up on No Film School, so look out for that. For upcoming events, keep your ears out over the next couple of weeks because there's a ton coming up. This week, we've got one, the Full Frame Documentary Film Festival. It's a notable film festival from Ryan's hometown of Durham, North Carolina. Is that your hometown?
It is. And if you have a chance to make it, it's a wonderful festival. Great setting. The weather's always great. It's very central, so you're not scattered all over town. You will be in line with directors you admire. I encourage you to make it to Durham, North Carolina, if you get a chance. That's April 7th through the 10th.
And even though it's a small festival, they definitely premiere films. We actually have an interview up on the site already with a film premiering there, with the director of a film premiering there. The director's Adam Irving, and the film is called Off the Rails. It's a really wacky premise. It's a documentary about a guy who's kind of a folk hero here in New York City because he's been imprisoned over 30 times for impersonating New York City's subway and bus drivers and taking over their routes. So we want to thank you guys for joining us for another week. And again, for helping us get up on that new and noteworthy section of iTunes. Please, please keep it up by subscribing, rating us.
We've got a couple more episodes from South by Southwest coming. I think I still have one from Sundance that I need to post. So a lot more great podcasts coming. We're really enjoying this. So again, thank you for rating us in iTunes. Indie Film Weekly is produced and edited by John Fusco. And as always, you can find this podcast and many others at nofilmschool.com.